Hello and welcome to Science Unscripted. It's Connor here.
And Gib.
And we have emails. I'm going to start with one I'll go here. This is from a biologist or a slash biology teacher who is together with his geologist wife, so kind of a science power couple, I would refer to them as. And hence, they are absolutely allowed to correct me or help me.
Uh-oh.
With regard to...
What'd you say now?
A single word I got kind of stuck on last episode. It was in connection with the deforestation of the Amazon causing a drop in precipitation.
Let me see if I can remember. Rainfall. Was this because the roots of the tree were sucking up the water and then evaporating it upwards?
Yes.
Into the sky?
Yeah. And this, the noun is transpiration.
Transpiration.
And I was trying to find the verb. And I was like, so yeah, they what do they do? And I'll just go to the right one as they correct me. You can tell he's a teacher. He says, you were not sure of the verb form of the word. Think perspiration, perspire.
Ah.
Respiration, respire.
Ah.
Transpiration.
Transpire.
Yeah.
When something happens.
Yeah.
Like
but that also feels wrong.
Yeah, that's because of that, the water. That would have tripped me up too.
The water transpires up into the air. I mean, you sound like you've
or speaking at least metaphorically or figuratively or something.
And the second part of the email, and this will kind of connect, I believe, to yours, Gabe, in just a second, goes on to say obituaries. We talked about this study showing how obituaries change over time, particularly after major dramatic events in a nation's history, sort of. The examples were 9/11, the COVID-19 pandemic, the financial crisis, that these events, if you look at millions, up to 40 million obituaries, will change how obituaries are written and also what values are sort of emphasized or de-emphasized.
Yeah.
Goes on to say, not to sound callous, but I think I would start, meaning if he were writing an obituary, with AI. Like ChatGPT, put down some point form notes and see what it turns out. Perhaps ask it to write it in different ways, such as a formal, informal, hopeful, dour tone, etc. And then goes on to say, I think at first I would try to make up a fictional character and list some things that people typically experience in life, make a list of family members, places they lived, worked, etc. Feed it into AI and see what comes out. So what I'll say there to Rob, one of our listeners, is that I did that.
Mm-hmm.
And if any of our listeners want to read the result of that fake obituary that I created for, I think AI called her Margot, M-A-R-G-O-T. I'm going to post it in the description notes on YouTube, DW Podcast on YouTube.
Nice.
That's kind of some cross promotion there, I guess, but more for people. It's not important enough to read all of it here, but you can get an idea of what AI can create obituary-wise. It feels really weird to read, kind of feel down and sad about the death of someone who never existed and whose entire life was fictionally kind of generated by AI. So I'll just repeat, DW Podcast on YouTube. Look in the description notes of this episode if you want to see that.
Yeah, we're also on TikTok, now that you mention it, Connor.
Oh, you're on TikTok. You're going viral, buddy.
This email is from Annie. Listen to this. I love reading obituaries that are in the first person. And then she starts writing in quotes, if you are reading this, I have died. Here is my story. And then Annie writes, the person gets to say in their own words what they want others to read about their legacy. Often it is someone that has a terminal illness and has time and thoughtfulness to write about it ahead of time. But we do not need to wait for death to be around the corner. We can start writing our own story now and just update it from time to time and make sure our important people know where it is. Cheers, Annie. And then she includes...
Hey, Gabe, are you coming? Yeah, man, I'll be there in a second. I'm just updating my obituary. I mean, it's a good idea, but it's a funny visual.
She includes an example of an obituary in the first person. I have not read this yet. I believe you have.
Okay, so
what's going on here?
Yeah, so it was the first one listed in this email that I have.
Yeah?
Our listener linked me to a kind of random website, one of those that just accumulates things and posts them. And the number one post on these 17 funny obituaries was the same one at the bottom of your email. So apparently people around the world who listen to us, some of them have already seen this obituary and were moved by it. I'll read it real quickly. I'll try to make it quick.
It's long.
It is long. There are a lot of ellipses in here. When I don't even say that, there are a lot of ellipses, three dots. It's from Emily Phillips. She died in 2015, was born in 1946, and wrote her own obituary. There's a lot of text. I'll read it quick. It pains me to admit it, but apparently I have passed away. Everyone told me it would happen one day, but that's simply not something I wanted to hear, much less experience. Once again, I didn't get things my way. That's been the story of my life, all my life. As a child, I walked to the old Hazelwood Elementary School, and she lists these teachers who influenced her and the reason she became a teacher. And so many things in my life seemed of little significance at the time they happened, but then took on a greater importance as I got older. The memories I'm taking with me now are so precious and have more value than all the gold and silver in my jewelry box. Memories, where do I begin? I remember mother wearing an apron, daddy calling square dances, my older sister pushing me off my tricycle, my younger sister sleepwalking out of the house, goes on to talk about her grandparents, and says, I remember cutting small rosebuds, still wet with dew, to wear to school on spring mornings, and I remember the smell of newly mowed grass. Goes on to talk about marrying the man of her dreams and becoming the grand diva of all things domestic as a result. To their surprise, they had a boy and a girl, that's what they're hoping for, who brought a wonderful sense of meaning to our lives. We've talked about that on this show. Just when I thought I was too old to fall in love again, became a grandmother, and my five grand angels stole my heart and also my money. So I was born, I blinked, and it was over. No buildings named after me, no monuments erected in my honor, but I did have the chance to know and love each and every friend as well as all my family members. How much more blessed can a person be? I'm going to stop it there, actually. I don't know if I can keep reading this, but beautiful, wow. Beautiful obituary. She had pancreatic cancer, so I had time, I suppose, to think about this, reflect on it. But there's an argument, if there ever was one, for writing in the first person.
How much better to read something like that than what we were discussing last week, where the idea was that the values that society thinks are important is what pops up in these obituaries. That's what scared me so much. I don't care about society. Society has nothing to do with me. When I die, I don't want society's, what's important in society to find its way into my obituary. That's what got me angry. And there's none of that in there.
No. We had speaking of YouTube again, one commenter I replied to saying, look, it's not that hard. You can make it funny. You can make it dry. You can dial it up this, that, or the other. And I responded by saying, I still think it's very difficult to do that well and capture the person and avoid being conventional, or to make it kind of unique, which again, an argument for writing it yourself. Kind of connected to all of this, it's such a dark topic, so let's move this toward like positive action away from death is my psychology here.
Yeah.
And that is some Max Planck research, and they looked at diseases, kind of connected to the pancreatic cancer that unfortunately took Emily Phillips in Florida. It's that if you have, let's say, a mild suspicion that you have a disease, like the ones from the study are Alzheimer's, Huntington's, a neurodegenerative disease, HIV, cancer, or diabetes. So you think, I might have this, right? Or there could be, whatever. It's in the family or my lifestyle.
Yeah.
One third of all people who have that suspicion will avoid any medical information about it. I'm not going to the doctor. I don't even want to research this. Just completely push it away from them.
Okay.
What they did for the study was a meta study looking at about 100 different studies, 500,000 people, 500,000 people in 25 countries, including Germany. This is pretty universal. It's not just one country where people avoid this for, say, financial reasons. And why do they do it? I'm going to quote the paper itself. It says, contrary to past findings, sociodemographic factors such as gender or race or ethnicity did not predict medical information avoidance. Mm-hmm. Strongest predictors were all cognitive. Information overload, you're kind of overwhelmed. Perceived stigma with certain diseases. Self-efficacy, probably the ability to go out and get this information yourself. And also, very importantly, trust in the medical system that was repeated again and again. That's kind of the policy action suggested as a result of this finding, help people trust doctors, hospitals. The other way of saying that, like all of this maligning of public health figures, especially as a result of the COVID pandemic, that probably increases this problem. That's for governments around the world to try to figure out. For all of our listeners out there, do your best. That's all I can say, to overcome that feeling, which is very human and normal. Oh my gosh, if I have that, I don't want to know. I don't even want to find out.
Look, I have a chronic disease, type 1 diabetes, and I know that feeling of trying to avoid it. I don't want to know anything about it, because when I address it, then I address my own affliction. I know that feeling, and it's not good. It's not good. There's no way that can end positively. The more you know about anything that's coming, is the better, right?
Well,
even if it hurts,
yeah,
or is not so comfortable.
Again, listed here: Alzheimer's, Huntington's, HIV, cancer, diabetes. Various therapies for each of those. In some cases, no cure. The therapies are still better than nothing. Only thing I can say is a result of this paper, which is called Prevalence and Predictors of Medical Information Avoidance in the Annals of Behavioral Medicine, is to be aware of that in yourself. If you're the kind of person, it's a cliche with men, oh, I don't need to go to the doctor. I don't go. That's a weakness, not a strength. Go ahead and make that trip.
Some more health news, I guess. We have talked about RFK Jr. in the past, the health secretary of the United States, some of the things that he have said that are questionable. We have looked into it, kind of fact-checked it. Back in April, he announced that he was going to present in September what he thought is responsible, the cause for the autistic spectrum, autism. By September, he said studies were going to be done internally, and they were going to present the cause of autism, namely environmental factors, not genetics. He was playing down the role that genetics plays in the development of autism and looking at environmental factors. And according to leaked reports published by the Wall Street Journal this week, he's looking at the painkiller acetaminophen.
Right. Common in these are over-the-counter drugs.
Right. Yeah. Known as paracetamol here in Europe, Tylenol primarily in the US and Canada. Very widespread use. Half of pregnant women take this. And he's looking at pregnant women. He's saying that when pregnant women take this, he's quoting it, it's calling it an intervention that, quote, most certainly leads to the development of autism. There is a lot of science that has been done, scientific studies that have looked into acetaminophen's role in autism. And there's so much that we have to, I mean, it's a meta-analysis at this point. The most recent one was done by researchers in UCLA and Harvard, and they looked at the 46 most comprehensive studies done on it to see if they could find a link. And there is no causal link. There are some studies that have pointed out that if pregnant women take acetaminophen, the likelihood that their children will develop autism goes up.
Well, it's correlational. That they are
right.
There's a correlation between people who end up being prescribed that painkiller and autistic children or autistic adults later in life, and that is very, very different than causal.
Right. The head of the study, a guy named Dr. Didier Prada, epidemiologist at Mount Sinai, which is where the study was, that's the main institution that was running the study. There were also researchers from other institutions, but it was Mount Sinai. He said, quote, ice cream sales go up in the summer, and also violent crime increases during summer. That doesn't mean that the one is causing the other. Maybe they're both going up because it's hotter.
Yeah, yeah.
Like that's an example, the causation versus association or versus correlation. Because pregnant women are taking acetaminophen doesn't mean that there's a causal link between them and their children getting autism. That is what has to be kept in mind when RFK Jr. announces this. And if someone comes to you and says, don't take Tylenol or don't take paracetamol, don't take acetaminophen because they heard that it's dangerous, look into the research. But also ask your doctor. That's the last thing that we say here. If you are pregnant, it doesn't matter what the medication is. What anyone says about a medication, that doesn't matter. Go and speak to your doctor first before taking anything.
Do you have anything to add to this discussion? I know, for example, I've read comments online already of women being approached by men who are pregnant. being approached by men who are saying, you know, be careful of this or that or the other because of these kinds of leaked announcements. It's already getting into the real world. Have you experienced it? Have you experienced something else? Anything else to say on this or going to the doctor or not going to the doctor when you should? Or obituaries or anything else that we've talked about on the show today? SU@dw.com. A fan of a certain kind of TV show that recreates a crime scene or figures out from the scene of a crime what happened to the victim. The one that pops in my head is CSI. Gabe, you've talked about Dexter, I think. That was a show you watched, maybe, or you reference it sometimes?
Yeah, he was in that field of work. He was also a serial killer.
Yeah, that's different.
Which kind of fits with the topic today.
I don't...
Murder?
Yeah. No, it's all about murder in the end and how somebody died and how they ended up where they ended up. Only the difference with this story is that it happened roughly 12,000 years ago.
Science Unscripted.
Okay. I can go ahead and get started. My name is Ben Udding. I'm a postdoctoral scientist at the Smithsonian National Museum of Natural History. And we just put out a paper on a 12,000-year-old murder victim in Vietnam.
A 12,000-year-old murder victim in Vietnam. Let's start with the scene of the crime, Ben. Where are we exactly in Vietnam?
We are about 85 kilometers south of the capital of Hanoi, so relatively far north in the country, at a site called the Trang An World Heritage Site. In a province called Ninh Binh. So this site is a UNESCO site. It's very scenic. It has some really beautiful views there, full of very tall karstic mountains covered in beautiful tropical rainforest.
What do 12,000-year-old human remains look like when you find them?
In a word, for us, they were a bit of a mess, to be honest. We were digging through a very sticky, moist sediment. Kind of clay-like, dark red to brown. So they're almost, I don't want to say sticky, but there's almost kind of a plastic deformation. They're not as you would imagine bone.
How do you know that this being was murdered?
That's a great question. Well, we found the human remains. They were very tightly bound together, as if someone after this person had died had taken care of him. We also found, in the process of excavating this very tightly compacted body, a small arrowhead made out of quartz. And we know it was an arrowhead because of the, I guess you could call them the flakes. So when you're making an arrowhead, you need to make it out of stone. And you can see how the people made the arrowhead based on how the stone broke apart. So we found that right in the same block of sediment with something called an accessory rib, which is a very small proportion of people have these ribs, but they're in the neck. This rib was broken and had evidence that the person didn't die immediately from the shot, but had maybe lived a few weeks to a month or so after he had been shot.
That's the part that got my attention, if I'm honest, Ben. This person gets shot in the neck with an arrow and then survives for a few weeks up to a few months, 12,000 years ago. How is that even possible?
So we think that this person was probably taken care of by a group of people that he was living with. But based on the way the bone was remodeled, we know that there was some healing, although it did get infected.
In the large scheme of things, why does this finding matter? I would assume that we found, you know, plenty of murdered humans before in the past. What's different or relevant about this one?
I think the major relevance for this is, first of all, we found relatively complete human remains. These are very rare from this part of the world because it's very hot and humid. So human remains don't preserve well. Not only that, we were able to retrieve some DNA from these remains, and that's even rarer. So we have this extraordinary archaeological assemblage of human remains, DNA, and this quartz point. And the quartz point for us is particularly interesting because we don't really have anything like it in the wider mainland Southeast Asia region at this time period. So I think this discovery really, the significance of it is that it raises so many questions that we didn't even know that we had.
And you said that this guy was dealing with some pretty serious infection. What is an indication with it from human remains that infections had happened?
So when bone is hit by something or it breaks, the bone begins to try to heal itself. But if something interrupts that healing, you can see that in the bone. And one type of evidence is called, the word is a draining cloaca, but it's a hole in the bone that essentially pus drains out of while the bone's trying to heal. But if the bone can't heal because if it's interrupted, you get all sorts of remodeling. We would call it remodeling on the surface of the bone. So it looks very distinct from healthy bone.
I have seen, for example, with my wife, she's gotten bitten by a little tiny fly, and that leads to a bacterial infection. If you scratch it, you have a bacterial infection in the skin. It threatens to become a blood infection. And I wonder so often, how did we make it this far when we're this susceptible to bacterial infections? Was the entry of the arrow an automatic death knell for this poor guy 12,000 years ago because a bacterial infection was absolutely going to happen? You can't avoid it? Or did he have? Do some people ever survive that back then?
That's a really great question. You're right. Bacterial infections can be extremely dangerous even today. And today we have antibiotics to help prevent that and heal that. Now, back then it's a bit harder to tell, but I can say that further out in the island Southeast Asia, in present-day Indonesia, we have evidence of the world's earliest surgery between 20, 30,000 years ago or so, if I'm remembering correctly. So that tells us that these people had pretty intimate understanding of human health and anatomy. And though this person, this man, had a very serious injury 12,000 years ago, I think that he would have had a community that cared for him. And if you look at human history, I think the key to how humans have been so successful in moving around the world and staying there and adapting is that we work together, we cooperate, and we take care of each other. So this person, despite having a horrific injury, would have had people caring for him in his final days, as unpleasant as they were.
Ben, how long did you work on this guy's remains?
We worked on this particular project for about 7 years, I'd say.
How do you keep going? I mean, this must be amazingly, painstakingly boring work, if I may say that. I mean, how do you keep going? What drives you as an archaeologist to just keep going over a span of 7 years, say?
Well, over the course of those 7 years, you always find new things, more questions. You know, the body poses you puzzles that you need to answer. And so while the day-to-day can get a little, I don't want to say mundane, but it can get a little discouraging, some things take a long time. There's always that kind of drive in the back of your head that you found this person and, you know, you owe it to this person to figure out who they were, how they lived, how they died. And this kind of thing takes time and you want to do things the right way. So while they take a long time, in the end, it turns out to be worth it.
And what does it feel like in a situation like this where the story becomes so clear to you and you're able to share it with the world and share it with Connor and me? We're sitting here smiling from ear to ear. What's that feel like?
To be honest, it's incredibly satisfying, you know, after that period of time, just to see that people are interested in this kind of work first and foremost, and that we're able to kind of spread a little more knowledge about this time and place to people around the world. There's a deep satisfaction in that.
When you lay down at night and you're like, yeah, I don't know, daydreaming or not quite dreaming, but you're thinking about the perfect find, the cave where you could find what you would hope to find in your life. What would that be for you?
Man, that's a tough question. For me, it would be something like this, where you have someone who you can tell who they were, you can tell who they died, but not only that, you can tell how they lived their life. And that, as archaeologists, is what we're really interested in, how people interacted with their environments, how they moved around, maybe even who they were interacting with. So in a site like this, you have kind of all those elements of such a fantastic discovery, and a discovery that's so rare for archaeologists.
And that was Benjamin Utting, a PhD candidate, talking to us from the Smithsonian Institute, and he was in Virginia in the U.S.
When we got the mics off, I apologized to him for using the word boring in one of those questions that I asked, but I was looking for a different word. I should have said, what is the word when you're working on one thing for 7 years? And he was dealing with one sack of bones for 7 years. And the idea in my head was that, can you imagine day in, day out, you're not getting anywhere. Like, I got from the elbow to the elbow this March.
Yeah, incredible resilience, grit, determination, yeah. Stamina.
Yeah. And I used the word boring, but then Ben immediately made me feel better about myself because then he laughed and said, oh, this job gets incredibly boring from time to time. So,
yeah, which then adds to the satisfaction of it all working out in the end. What this leaves me wondering is whether now it's sitting on a shelf in the house I grew up in. There's a couple arrowheads that my uncle, whenever he'd go out, Colorado usually, but Colorado, Arizona, U.S. states, very dry, high, and you can go out and find arrowheads. And I have some, and I would guess that they're made of something like quartz. Are they from the same time period? It's so hard to fathom things that were that long ago that I think you need a story, a personal story like that, to even get a glimpse. And if you go look at the paper, it'll help you even more. It's open access, first of all, which is great. Not all papers are. But it's called TBH1: 12,000-year-old human skeleton and projectile point shed light on demographics and mortality in terminal Pleistocene Southeast Asia. One thing that jumps out at me in that paper, among the other imagery, is the fact that apparently this guy had a sprained ankle.
On top of everything else.
A sprained ankle. Yeah, which then I'm wondering, well, yeah, if you're trying to get away from somebody who's shooting you, who's trying to kill you for whatever reason, you might sprain that ankle as part. What, just to be able to even imagine that or think that is amazing. I'm grateful for Ben's 7 years of research helping me see that.
He could have sprained his ankle anyway, any time. What's more amazing is the fact that he got hit with an arrow in the neck and then dealt with months of infection before saying goodbye to this earth. And here we are talking about this guy.
Yeah. And here you are comparing your miniature tooth operation to this guy who's literally shot in the neck with an arrow. Are you like him, Gabe? Is that
Well, maybe that's the question for anyone listening to this right now. What's the worst pain you've ever encountered? Because it's nothing compared to what this guy in Vietnam dealt with 12,000 years ago.
Send us your stories of pain, and maybe next week we'll compare them or rank them against what ended in a cave in northern Vietnam. Let us know. We're su@dw.com.
DW, made for minds.